Good morning. You are tuned in to Community Radio KGNU, and it's time for the January installment of our monthly radio book club. It's a collaboration with the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran. As always, my co-host is Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. And I'm delighted to say we had a Colorado proud book this month. I'm always delighted to have Colorado stories and Colorado authors for the book club.
Yeah, we had Kevin Wolf. He's here with us. Who wrote The Home Place, a mystery set on the eastern plains of Colorado. And I agree. You know, I think the writing scene in Colorado is really vibrant. And so I love to find people who are doing great work in Colorado. And I thought this would be a great book because I thought, you know, we've read some heavy books. So I thought, you know, kind of a mystery and kind of something that moves fast would be fun. And I had taken a trip last spring to La Junta and seen some of the eastern plains, and I thought it'd be great to get a book set out there. And so Kevin's book fit the bill.
It was a great book, a super duper page turner. We're delighted, as Arsene said, to have Kevin Wolf join us live in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me this morning.
And we have had some mysteries in the past in the Radio Book Club, but this, I think, for me, fit right in that classic mystery page turning genre. Now, I'm not an expert and I haven't read that many, but I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Well, you don't win the Tony Hillerman Award for, you know, nothing. So you got to be able to write a mystery. Yeah, and this is set up as a traditional mystery to some extent. You have the body is found right away, but the true attraction to the story, to some extent, is really, to me, was this Colorado landscape. And if you could talk about you're the descendant of homesteaders, and what did the eastern Colorado give to the story and setting it there? How did that help shape what you wrote?
Just before I started on The Home Place, I'd finished a manuscript that actually takes place in Rocky Mountain National Park, so much different than the eastern plains. And I'd had this connection because my mother's side of the family were homesteaders in eastern Colorado. And I wanted in this process, the setting became before the story. I just wanted to write a story that happened on the eastern plains. I think they've got, when you compare the beauty of the eastern plains with the mountains, it's more subtle and more quiet. And it's a part of Colorado that people drive through or fly over to get to here so they can go skiing. And it's missed, but I think there's something out there. And my connection with that, my family's ground out there for the last, I can't put a number on how many years that we've traveled out there, you know, for family events, to see the place. And my mother's older brother never married and was kind of my second dad. He was he would work construction all his life. He was the guy that if you needed to fix something, he had the tool, probably three of them. He had, you know, if you wanted to go fishing, he could go, and come hunting season, they'd chase the antelope out there at the home place. You know, he took me and my cousin, and it was just from seeing it in those snippets and seeing how the land changed over the people and the communities changed. I thought it was something that I could put in a story and show that subtle beauty and talk about the people that lived out there.
But one of the things I loved are the people, the characters in your book. Each one of them could have their own book, I thought. I mean, we have Birdie, who I guess she was always in love with the protagonist, who we'll talk about in a minute. But she's a wildlife officer. She just sounded like this. Somebody I'd love to be friends with. I mean, I really, really enjoyed Birdie. There's the kind of crooked sheriff a little bit. I guess he's not necessarily terribly crooked, but not a nice guy.
Kendall. He's always preening.
Pandering to the television cameras.
And very politically motivated, yes.
Yes, and then there's the protagonist. And then, I mean, there's a whole host of characters. And as I said, it really gave a very full picture, I suppose, of this small town. When you start out writing something like this, how much backstory do you have to create for yourself that doesn't necessarily go into the book for each of these characters? Because they really are, each one is very rich, and their own story really plays a big part in the ultimate story.
Yeah, that's a very good question. In fact, let me answer it this way. I'm working on a sequel where we take the characters from this book on another round of adventures, and Just this week, I was writing a scene, and I found myself overwriting it to get the back, so I could tell myself the backstory of a character, and then I just just last night I trimmed it back down to what I'd written maybe was about 15 pages, and I trimmed it down to about 9 of what really the story was. But I told my, you know, those 6 missing pages are definitely filed away, because it's telling me a lot about the character that was in the scene I was working with.
Well, and then there are details too, particularly in a murder mystery where details are very important because they're clues in many ways. Do you have to be very, very careful about, okay, this happened here at this location, even, you know, thinking about future books, if they're going to be connected in any way?
It's a challenge, and I hope I have that challenge to take this into several, take these characters and do some other things with them. I think if you get, with any writing, if you get too much to the formula, you might lose the story. So you have to make sure, you know. And I see myself as more of a storyteller than a writer, and so I want to I want the rhythm of the story to bring in those elements at the right time.
I like the word rhythm, because I felt this book had such a great rhythm. You know, the story is, one of the main parts of the story, obviously, is this guy, Chase, who was a basketball player, the town hero, and he hasn't been to the town since he graduated high school, and he went on to have a career with the Lakers, and he's back for the weekend hunting, but then all these murders are happening. You know, the basketball coach, who was the high school coach, the basketball star of the high school, who was the kind of the biggest star since Chase, and so he comes back, and then you tell the story from, we see Chase's, not his point of view, it's third person, but we see it from Chase, through Chase, see it through Birdie, we see it through, you know, Mercy, the deputy sheriff, we see it through all these different angles, and it feels like a dance almost, as you move from character to character, and just trying to give us these different, so the story has a real rhythm to it as you move in points of view and in time.
Yeah, by doing it that way, I was hoping that the reader would have more of the story than any one of the characters. And so that, I think one of the fun things about reading mysteries is you want to think you're smart and you know what's happening and you know who did it. And so by doing it with this format of revolving points of view, the reader would have information that some of the characters didn't. And yeah,
I thought the rhythm was very central to their dialogue as well. There was a wonderful cadence to how they spoke, and it was very rhythmic. And also the pacing, and I suppose pace and rhythm go hand in hand, because I noticed, you know, we're seeing the story from different characters' perspectives, and it seemed to speed up at the end as we're getting close to the, you know, the big reveal of who did it and why. And so I thought rhythm was a huge part of this. And it got me turning the page faster and faster.
Yeah, and with playing with writing from different characters' points of view, I tried to at sometimes to as a reader, I would say, I want to know what's happened with this character. What's going to be the next thing? But then I would purposely move that further down the book so that we'd put something in some other character's part of the story in between.
So we've talked about setting and some of the individual characters. Well, the plot is interesting. You've, like I said, you have this guy, Chase Ford, who played for the Lakers and has now come back, and he's got some demons. He's gone through a marriage that kind of puttered out. His career ended because of an injury. He's pondering a new job opportunity. And he gets back to the town after 16 years, and he doesn't look up the people. You know, he ends up running into them all, but he doesn't look them up. What gave you the idea of this kind of heroic son, prodigal son almost, both in one in a way, returning to this town and you know, while all this action's taking place, and whether he is, you know, some suspect maybe he's part of the action, or is others, or is it just a coincidence? But what gave you that idea for that's what's going to start the story?
Somebody said that there's only really two kinds of stories: somebody goes home or somebody leaves home. And so I think I had that foundation to work with. And the Chase Ford character was very fun for me, and I wanted him to, as a character that hadn't been home in 16 years, then the changes in the community would be more. He would be the one that recognized those. So that was part of it. And then I wanted him to be a reluctant hero, because there's two or three times in the story where he just says, what am I doing here? I should leave. Maybe the town would be better off without me. There's nothing I'm going to do here to help with this. I should just leave. And then the cards fall on the table, and he feels he just must do something. Yeah. And then I wanted to play him off of the characters that were there, that had looked up now, that think that he's the guy that's made it. And really, I think Chase just would have been content staying there on the farm if the life's events wouldn't have taken him away.
There's a lovely scene towards the end of the book where he comes across this family. There's a big snowstorm, as always, when, you know, we're getting close to the climax. It's a terrible storm and it's going to shut down the highway. But he helps this family, young couple and a baby, get their car out of a snowdrift. And baby, turns out, is named after him. And it turns out there are loads of babies named after him because he's so well-liked in the community. And he's genuinely so shocked by this. It really goes to what you said there, that not just a reluctant hero, he just does not see himself in that way at all.
Yeah, very, very, very much so. And then we contrast him with some of the other characters that want to be more important than maybe they really are, but they're the big fish in the small pond.
We're speaking with author Kevin Wolfe this morning on KGNU. It's the monthly installment of the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran. My co-host, as always in the Radio Book Club, is Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. And Kevin Wolfe's new book is a mystery. It's called The Home Place, and it's set in the eastern plains of Colorado.
So I want to give the listeners a chance to hear you read just a little section. And, you know, Maeve and I, we're talking with you before we got into the studio, and we both love the character of Birdie. And so this is where our people meet Birdie. She's the fish and game warden, but she gets pulled into this murder mystery because she's got to help law enforcement. And so maybe you could just read this passage where we meet Birdie.
This comes very early in the story, just about page 6. Let me jump in. Birdie Hawkins blew out a deep breath and turned away from the bandy rooster of a man who paced back and forth down the length of the driver's side of her truck. She slammed the door shut on the state-owned pickup truck she drove every day. Birdie needed a layer of window glass between her and the lunatic outside. She pressed the speed dial number on the state-owned cell phone and waited for it to connect. Birdie combed her stubby fingers through the thick, brush-short hair on the top of her head. She'd never thought of herself as a girly girl, and most of the people in the county didn't either, but the little dickhead outside was calling her sir. Maybe it was time she started wearing earrings or makeup, or eye makeup like Marty's wife begged. The dispatcher answered the phone on the third ring. Arlene, this is Birdie. I need some help out here. You know where Marty's at? Little man stormed to the front of Birdie's truck. He shook his fist at her and pointed to the field beyond the fence. Birdie didn't want to look at it again, but it was better than watching the turd bucket rant. Four brown lumps decorated the sweep of sage and prairie. She shook her head. Yesterday, they'd been living, breathing buffalo worth upward of $4,000 each. Today, they were fly bait with bullet holes in their woolly sides. Dead buffalo fell under the sheriff department's jurisdiction. If these were pronghorn or deer, it would be up to her as county game board to figure out what happened. She'd tried to explain that to the little madman doing the war dance, but he didn't want to hear any of it. Arlene told Birdie about Marty's car trouble and that she'd send a wrecker out to tow him into town. I'll call him, Birdie said. And Arlene, do me a favor. Run this license plate. She rattled off a string of numbers and letters. It's a red Ford half-ton with a Brandon Buffalo sticker on the back bumper. Birdie was afraid she knew who the truck belonged to, and if she knew, Arlene would too. And through the phone, Birdie heard a gasp. Oh dear, Arlene said.
That's Kevin Wolfe reading. You know, one of the things I like about that passage is, you know, you mentioned we're meeting Birdie there, and you say she's not a girly girl, I think you said there, and which is very, very true, as we find out. But the other women, the other two main women, Mercy, who owns the cafe and was Chase's high school girlfriend, and Jody Rose, I believe, the TV reporter, they do use their feminine wiles in the story. And so you kind of have you set up kind of Birdie as almost the opposite of those women. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit. And
oh, wow. That's that's a great question. Birdie was a fun character. And when I started the story, Birdie was going to be the deputy sheriff. And partway, I think I hadn't even gotten 25 pages in. I said, no, she should be the game warden because that's going to give her more freedom in the story to do some things. Birdie is, she was the tomboy in high school. She was the kid that didn't fit in. She was snuck out for a cigarette and cut class. She you know, hung around the basketball team, and her family had moved around, and she finally finds friends in this little town. And she's and of the characters, you look at the characters that Chase leaves town and comes back. Marty, the deputy sheriff, really never left. But Bertie left and came back when the job allowed her to come back to the place that she really wanted to be. And she's the guy's friend. And then we get to Mercy, the ex Chase's ex-girlfriend, that probably that wanted to leave Brandon. Her as a high school student, she couldn't wait to get out of this little town, and she felt trapped with her. Her father was the banker. Her mother owned the cafe. She remembered that when people in the county never used the front doors of their houses. Everybody entered through the kitchen. And the only time their mother opened the front door was when she hung up the Christmas decorations. And she wanted to get out of there. And certainly, when she's also had a marriage that fails, and now she's basically trapped in this little town. And one point in the book, there's the town gathers for a pancake supper in a church basement, and she refers to that as the society event of the year in this little town. So yeah, they're very, very different. Jody Rose comes in as the murders happen and the crime. She's sent from Colorado Springs to report, and she's definitely an ambitious, a career oriented, and sees this as a chance to. You know, as a career move for her, and she uses anything she can to weasel stories out of sheriffs and tries to get in front of Chase and anything she can to her advantage.
As I said at the beginning, I was so excited to read another book by a Colorado author, but very much set in Colorado. And even though this is the Eastern Plains, and for many people who may not have been there, there's still lots of nuggets in here that will ring so true. No matter where you live in Colorado, Chase, before he was playing for the Lakers, he was at CU Boulder mm-hmm. playing for the Buffs. So there's a reference to that. There's, of course, the big winter storm that comes in and shuts down the highway. But there's also a very detailed description of a fire, a wildfire, and the volunteer fire crew who come out to fight it. And the detail into how they, you know, dig a trench, and it was Chase and I think Marty, the deputy sheriff, who had to hook up a tractor, and so much detail went into that. And of course, this particular area is no stranger to wildfires, and know the importance of having a volunteer firefighting crew and how the entire community comes on board. What kind of research did you do for that, particularly that passage where I said there's a lot of detail about hooking up a tractor, digging a trench, and this is the type of thing where I could see readers who are very familiar with this being very, you know, aware of the details. And so were you conscious of that when you were writing this passage?
Yeah. And on one of the trips to the family homestead, they told us the story of a wildfire that had started down there in the Flat Prairies. Now, this is dry land farming territory where you rely on rain. There's no irrigation. And in Colorado, you got 1 out of 3 years when it's not going to rain at all, and crops just burn in the field, and are a bonfire waiting for a spark. And they can be, you know, we all are aware of how the wind can blow on the Eastern Plains. So imagine now these dry weeds and crops getting started on fire and getting pushed by a wind. And the way they fight fires is you get out in front of it, you get, as the wind's bringing the fire to you, and you try to take away the fuel. And you do that by plowing up fields, digging holes, making fire breaks, even using or forcing the fire, channeling the fire to roads and stuff to become the fire break. And, you know, just from listening to them describe how they weren't even, my relatives weren't even really on the volunteer fire force, but the fire came and they just called for they were close. They had tractors and the firemen directed them where to tear up this field. And did some reading on it in a couple other places. And the other thing, you know, in those small communities, everybody's a volunteer fireman. They just expect you to do that for your community. And in fact, if I take this book forward, with these characters, Earl Collins, the chief of the volunteer fire department, is going to be very much a part of the next story.
Well, that's one thing I liked about the book. The community really comes together. Everybody knows each other for good and for bad. I mean, you're stuck with the kids in high school that you didn't like, you know, for instance. But at the same time, they all know each other, and there is this camaraderie, and there is this people know who Marty is, and people know who Birdie is. They know all these people, whether it's the guy who's suffering from Alzheimer's, and you know, they all know each other, and it's very close knit. And in that way, I thought it was really a perfect setting for a mystery, you know, among these characters, you know, almost like a closed door.
It's almost a manor house mystery.
Yeah, that's what I meant, a locked room mystery.
But the manor house is a full county of Colorado. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk to you about that high school. So when Chase comes back and they go to that pancake supper in the church basement, they're almost back into their high school roles. They fall into that pretty quickly. You know, like they're hanging out as a gang. It's like the gang's all here again, you know, very briefly.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think in these small communities or maybe it's universal that people will revert to that or come, you know, like... I thought that was very interesting how they fell into those high school relationships pretty quickly.
So I was reading someplace not too long ago, and that somebody suggested that we really all live in a small town, even though it might be in the middle of a big city. That, you know, we pretty much frequent the same restaurants, we go take our clothes to the same dry cleaners, we go to the drugstore, and we know the pharmacist, even though we just see them in this small. Circle that we travel in, you know, we at church, at work, you know, we pretty much see the same people that day. Maybe people are only wired to recognize X number of people, and in a small town, that's a set number, and you don't have a whole lot of choice. When we get in these bigger communities, maybe we have the opportunity to pick and choose who we interact with, and that, I still. I don't talk to a whole lot of guys I went to high school with, but every so often, actually, they found me on Facebook when the book came out, and what they reminded me of was, you know, congratulations for writing the book, but hey, remember when you missed those free throws in the game against Cherry Creek, you know, that kind of stuff. So I think, you know, I think that we all have, whether it was good or bad, for most of us, it's probably a combination. That, you know, that there's a foundation right there, and I think it's just because that's when we're becoming who we are, is in those years where we've moved from a child to you know, all the intellectual things that have happened. So I think that's why that period in life is important to us.
Mm-hmm. Maeve had asked you about setting clues into the story or trying to keep track of all that. Do you have a place where you feel like, you know, I want the readers to have figured it out by this point, or a really astute reader could figure it out here, but then I'm going to start feeding more and more clues? Because my personal experience with this book was I figured it out about the perfect place for me. I was probably 3/4, maybe 4/5 of the way through the book, and it wasn't 100% obvious, but there was something that happened, which I don't want to reveal, and I said, aha! And that was very, very satisfying. As creating a mystery, you probably want your reader to have that aha moment. And so how do you construct it?
Well, let me just back up a little bit. As I started writing this story, I didn't set out to write a mystery. I set out to write this story about these characters on the plains, and the setting was very important. And I didn't lay. I thought it was more of a suspense piece as I wrote, because there's some things in there. And as we did the final edits and with my agent before we really got ready to do some shopping with the book, you know, that's when I moved some details around to make it more of a mystery. There's some things I planted in there that I wanted to be obvious, and I wanted them to be so obvious that people said, it can't be. And, I didn't purposely set out. From the time I started the story, I knew where it was going to end, and I knew how it was going to end. I knew, you know, I'm not one of those. While I'm not a strict outliner, I'm not a guy that discovers the story at the keyboard. And I knew where I was going to start. I knew what was going to end. I knew I had to have a big event in the middle to kind of hold up anything that would sag. And I, you know, that's the structure. But as far as planning clues, and I've been very satisfied with the people that have, you know, the reviews, and more from the people that have read the book and found me through my website and came back and said how much they enjoyed it, and told me how, oh, I knew it was, but I never didn't know why, or I had it figured out and I knew what was going on, or I had no clue. And I thought, if I'm doing that, if I did that, I did a pretty good job.
But I was in that category where I think I figured it out early, but I had no idea why. And that really came at the end. And so that definitely kept the pages turning. And so I would imagine that as a mystery writer, finding that balance is something that's obviously very crucial. If you give it away too soon, there's no reason for people to continue to the end. Well, we're speaking with the author Kevin Wolfe this morning on the Radio Book Club on KGNU, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. We just have a couple of minutes left before we have our own reveal, which is February's selected title. But The Home Place was the book we've been reading this month. It was the winner of the Tony Hillerman Prize, which was it's very prestigious. I mean, how important are these prizes for authors?
Of course, Tony Hillerman is the New Mexico author that wrote the 20 novels that all happen on the Indian reservations in New Mexico and Arizona, a little bit in Utah. He was an educator, you know, as a professor at the University of New Mexico, and as when he came up with the idea for this prize, it was to help authors that have been out there but hadn't had their break. And it's my understanding, I think I won in 2015, which I believe was the 11th year of the contest, and they awarded 7 prizes, so they didn't give the prize away every year. Getting this, I mean, this took this book from I went from a guy that had an agent and 6 manuscripts that we were trying to sell to a prize winner that was published with one of the big 5s, Minotaur Press, and with the little emblem on there. So it was a very prestigious award, and I'm very fortunate.
Well, congratulations. And I certainly personally really enjoyed this. Mystery is not a genre I typically gravitate towards, but when it's done well, it's a great read, and this was a really enjoyable book. I think I finished it in about 3 sittings, which is no mean feat. I got a couple of small kids, so I had
Thank you very much.
Really get engaged with this story. But The Home Place, a mystery novel set on the Colorado Eastern Plains, was the book we've been reading along with. Hopefully you've been reading with us this month in the Radio Book Club. Find out more. We're linking to Kevin's website at news.kgnu.org. But as always, at the end of our show, we always reveal our own exciting news, which is the next selection. And this is a completely different book, Arson, that you have chosen for our readers for February. Author Scott Carney, he's not a local author, but he's local right now. I know he's part of the Scripps Fellowship at CU Boulder, but he has written a book, What Doesn't Kill Us. It's not a murder mystery. What's that about?
Well, what doesn't kill us makes us stronger, is the saying. So this book is What Doesn't Kill Us. Scott looked at these people who do these amazing physical feats. You know, they plunge into ice-cold water. They do all these things that humans don't usually do. And somehow that's supposed to make them stronger, impact our evolution. And so Scott came by the store, and I started talking with him. And one thing led to another, and me and Scott actually made snow angels out in the snow without our clothes on.
I saw the photos, and I was horrified that I thought I might have to partake in something like that. But that's been done. We're just going to read the book.
I don't know if it made me any stronger. It just made me cold and wet. But Scott seemed to get some strength from it. And so he did a lot of research on this book, and he talked to people who are doing this in a much more rigorous way, and he kind of became a convert to it. So it's going to be fun to talk to him. I mean, the first question is going to be, are you crazy? But after that, hopefully it'll be a good conversation.
Well, author Scott Carney, his latest book is What Doesn't Kill Us. He's going to join us on February 23rd. That's Thursday, February 23rd at 9 a.m. Tune in then. You don't have to wait till then, though, because he's actually going to be speaking next Tuesday at the Boulder Bookstore, Tuesday, January 31st at 7:30. He's going to be talking about that. So if you want to go along then, and then, of course, read along with us and hear Scott Carney join us on February 23rd. The Radio Book Club is a monthly show here on KGNU, and it's a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. It's also a podcast available on iTunes, and in addition to the author interviews, we have an After Hours at the Book Club podcast only segment. It's also available actually at our website, and we're going to get into a little bit more whimsical topics with our authors. And so Kevin Wolfe will be segueing into our After Hours studio in just a moment, and that will be available at the iTunes podcast as well. But in the meantime, I'd like to thank my co-host as always, Arson Kashkashian with the Boulder Bookstore, and Kevin Wolfe. It's been a delight to have you in. Very much enjoyed The Home Place.
Thank you so much.
It is 9:30. You're listening to Community Radio KGNU. Stay tuned for the Morning Sound Alternative.